It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Thursday morning, and we take a look at media and the media coverage and the events that the media is covering. David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us, and he's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I'm glad to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, reviewing the week once more with the ever watchful Marshall Miles. I guess we have to talk about Ukraine still. Huh?
You know, it's yeah, we do. There's a lot going on with you that all basically surrounds and goes off of the Ukraine. The thing that I was talking about yesterday, David, is that I remembered early in the week this week. The big fanfare the Russians made about their ships coming into Mariupol and docking there, they actually put video out on it. And I said to myself, you know, with today's society, with the amazing drones and with the weapons that are out there that the Ukrainians are using, I don't know how wise that was. And sure enough, the Ukrainian army managed to blow up that big supply ship and damage two other warships that were next to it. You wonder what is the Russian hierarchy thinking in this war?
Not the wisest piece of information management. Even though we think of the Russians as being somewhat adept at information management, it's in the essence of the totalitarian regime which Russia seems to have redeveloped to manage information. In this case, they sort of issued an open invitation to Ukraine, well, even not so much the Ukraine army in this case. For the first time, the Ukraine Navy claiming credit for a particular action. And, it's very hard to say when you're not only on the ground or on the waves, but it does appear from a distance to have been a remarkable tactical success, getting the supply ship sink, and if it's true what the Ukrainians are saying, that supply ship was full of tanks ready to land on the southern reaches of Ukraine, then it's a far from insignificant piece of military action by the Ukrainians. But on the wider plan, it raises, as you say, with this information management field to be considered, it's our job, I think, as discerning readers, listeners, and viewers of the Ukraine situation. Vladimir Putin's war, as most of the world's people see it, certainly world governments, we have to attempt some careful interpretation of the diplomatic moves and the propaganda moves, if you like, looking especially for shifts from one day to another, from one week to another. And we know it's a war of words as well as of deadly weaponry, so we need to be on a special outlook for possible shifting in the parties' stated negotiating positions. We're at that point now, I think, in this war, that especially now that Russian forces appear to be blocked from any substantial geographic advances in Ukraine, even while they are still increasingly bludgeoning cities with heavy military, heavy artillery and missiles, conducting a mercilessly grinding siege strategy, it seems to be now. It's not exactly a stalemate, but it's certainly bogged down. So what changes can we register at the informational level? We can probably sum it up this way. There's no longer, interestingly, any loud noise from Russia about decapitating the Volodymyr Zelensky government in Kiev, even while Moscow does continue with its pre-existing and continuing demands for Ukraine to watch, to recognize the breakaway areas of eastern Ukraine region, which lumped together we can call Donbass. that's Donetsk and Lugansk, those cities to the cities and surrounding regions to the east of the country, already Russian speaking and long supplied by Russia with the military means to maintain their so-called independence. Plus, of course, the Russians are still wanting a guarantee of future neutrality for Ukraine and no entry into NATO. But the idea, the Russian idea of a regime change in Kyiv seems to have faded. That's not top of mind for the Russians, it seems to me now. And it seems pretty clear as you look around all the output of the Russian official sources, even denazification, which is one of their other ways of describing the need to get rid of the Ukraine government, was being described by Putin and his henchmen originally. That's fainter than it was. In fact, faded away to a large extent. And meanwhile, on the Ukrainian side, if we look at that, President Zelensky chose ABC News here in the States to acknowledge publicly, and I quote him here, the translation at least, we understand that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine. I mean, there's disappointment there, sure. Zelensky has always wanted, in recent years, has wanted Ukraine to join NATO eventually. But I guess it's now, a considered realism on his part. He's also repeatedly calling for direct top-level talks between himself and Putin. Now, this talk of talks, I don't want to sound Pollyannish. It's the last thing I want to be. But we can see, if we're clinical about it, there is some room here in this these shifts that are going on, these slightly shifting positions for negotiation. Currently, the talks at a low functionary level between the two countries are going on, and they're being sponsored or brokered, certainly encouraged by both Turkey and Israel from the outside. And given the shift in the war of words, if you like, is significant too. So watch this space, I would say, as we used to say on television.
Yeah, looking at all the surrounding stories and how this has turned into Vladimir Putin's worst nightmare. I mean, I would figure he doesn't have many nightmares in his life, but this is one, because the ground operation not only is stalled, as Ukraine is actually gaining back ground that they lost. Ukraine has now obviously been stocked by not only the United States, but weapons from the European Union in general, and they now have weapons power. And the Russians basically had put so much into the beginning of this that the only way that they can try to do anything is what you've talked about, is to just the scorched earth policy, which is leaving their reputation far, far behind. And now President Biden went to and spoke with NATO and the European Union. He's now going to Poland, signed this big deal that we will deliver more natural gas to replace the Russian natural gas. This has really turned into a huge nightmare for Vladimir Putin.
Certainly a major international isolation, which is not really what was ever conceived of with the grandiose notion of a growing and substantial and deeply established Russian sphere of influence. We as commentators can describe it as a Russian empire, but that's not something that even Putin ever talks about in an actual that actual description. But imperial thoughts certainly lay behind. We can analyze and surmise that they lay behind his ambitions here in Ukraine. His own writings have a very imperial ring about them when it comes to Ukraine and the notion that Ukraine is merely part of the overall Russian entity. So yes, the very clear signaling from the beginning was that this would be it wasn't just a cover phrase, that idea of a military operation, and the word war was banned by the Russians on pain of 15 years imprisonment, indeed, for journalists and commentators online and in broadcasting. But that notion that that the military operation was going to be just that, a short-term operation, that was the underlying assumption for all that brash talk at the beginning, that this would be over in a few days, and that Kyiv would be seized, and indeed, as I was saying before, the government replaced. In the Russians' own somewhat fantastical terms, the threatened populations of Ukraine be liberated. Well, it's we're now moving into the second month of this limited operation. Things have certainly not gone the way that the Russians appear to have expected from the beginning. I want to make another note, by the way, following up our discussion last week on the cost of news gathering in this war. We should note that another journalist has been killed since we last talked, this time a Russian journalist, Oksana Balina, who worked for one of the few remaining independent outlets known as the Insider. She died in a northern district of the capital, Kyiv. She was trying to report on the damage being done by the fairly long-range military artillery was being aimed at those northern parts of the capital. And she herself became a victim of Russian rocket fire. Balina and her Insider colleagues built up an impressive journalistic record, we should remember, of investigating the Putin regime's evident nerve poison attacks on its enemies, like the now jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny, and that prolific writer Dmitry Bykov, another two, like the Skripal family, the father and daughter who were poisoned in Salisbury, England. Another loss to journalism, I have to report.
Yeah, just absolutely amazing to look at it. And one final note: I think that the Russian ships out in the ocean off of Crimea that are shooting these cruise missiles, I think they're going to be on high alert now after the Ukrainians sank those three ships in the port of Mariupol. I think that also sent a message that you're not even safe out there.
Right, and the hardware, which is now reaching, it's been reaching from the beginning, but now ramped up considerably from the West, NATO in particular. Although, the Biden administration is very, very clear about no greater actual military involvement on the Ukrainian side in support of the Ukrainians. But nonetheless, the weaponry that's in the hands of the Ukrainians is being used to considerable effect.
All right.
Shall we move on?
Let's
look at some domestic issues.
You
go first.
No. You take the lead here.
All right. The biggest domestic news, I guess, is the Senate confirmation hearings for Biden's new nominee for the Supreme Court. I would have thought to a slightly different source for that story, at least from an observational standpoint. The late-night talk show hosts of this country can sometimes be a helpful political barometer at a time of watershed episodes in American national life, like the Senate hearing for a new Supreme Court nominee. The Senate here is, of course, exercising its advice and consent role, and the administration is clearly, hoping for complete consent confirmation for Ketanji Brown Jackson in the role of the newest member of the Supreme Court. But Republican senators' supposed grilling of the judge was often revealing of some really questionable racial attitudes underlying them, now that they were confronted with the first ever female black nominee. And Jimmy Kimmel, amongst those late night hosts, was very pointed in his remarks. And I want to quote them now, because they probably sum the situation up better than any of the miles and miles of column inches that have been devoted to this subject in the media this week. Let me quote him. He was addressing the Republicans directly. "I think your dog whistle's busted, guys. Everybody can hear it now." And it's worth noting Kimmel's other barbed comment. "Not every Republican was impressed at all by the judge. Senators Marsha Blackburn and Josh Hawley were like, 'You lost us at Ketanji.'" And also, if there doesn't have to be particularly concentrated our observation on the racial attitudes being suggested here, but there was if there was a prize awarded by the press for just the most boorish performance in the Senate committee across the board, not just on racial matters. It would have been given to Lindsey Graham, I think. His performance this week was, could be called hectoring the witness, I believe it's called in courtrooms, incessantly interrupting and loudly lecturing the nominee. Several reporters I noted referred to his baring his teeth. It's not an image I'd ever want to linger over, but I mentioned it in passing. And we can perhaps all remember Graham dominating, or maybe the right word is domineering, the coverage of Justice Kavanaugh's confirmation hearing, when he pretty much lost it then, too. And I'm calling his boorishness a performance with this simple... I mean, we know senators always grandstand in these opportunities. That's in essence... what they see them as being, an opportunity to grandstand. But to what degree it was an act, if you like, is this simple fact that Lindsey Graham voted for Judge Jackson being appointed to her previous judicial positions on the Federal District Court and then the D.C. Court of Appeal only last year, voted for this judge that he's now bad-mouthing so boorishly. I think we can all make our own judgments about that.
It's it's a scene that has become it's like everything it gets more and more acrimonial every time whoever goes up to be in front of a Senate panel, it deals more and more with political issues and not the issues of the qualification of the person that's being nominated, and that's where it really goes off the rails. It's pretty amazing to see that.
Yeah, absolutely, and in this case. Graham was kind of relitigating that last nomination procedure with Justice Kavanaugh. He was even trying to, in some fantastical, illogical way, trying to make Judge Jackson answer for the appalling treatment, as he saw it, of her predecessor being appointed to the court. It was nonsensical. Social and political advance, another female first, promised by Judge Jackson, if she's confirmed, becoming the first black female on the High Court. We perhaps ought to pause this morning and recognize an earlier extraordinary first female, the first female Secretary of State for the United States, Madeleine Albright, now dead at 84. Her family fled from communism in Czechoslovakia, and three of her grandparents were Holocaust victims of Nazism. So twice over, she's been at a very young age a refugee, and it was heartening to hear about her own reflections on being a refugee and how important it is that America fulfills its long traditional historical role of welcoming refugees. It was a lovely story she did like to repeat herself about being Secretary of State at a swearing-in ceremony for new citizens and hearing one of the new U.S. citizens say about herself that she was a refugee, and here she was getting her citizenship letter for citizenship certificate with a covering letter from the Secretary of State saying that she was now an American citizen, and Madeleine Albright stepped in to say, well, you know, the Secretary of State herself was a refugee. It was a consistent theme in her public statements about her own life. Those early days of her family's persecution only became evident to her when she had reached the top position of the State Department. She didn't know until then that her family even was Jewish. She was brought up Catholic, or at least the family was of a Catholic persuasion. She was appointed by President Clinton, of course, first as UN ambassador, which is where I first met her when I was at the UN in the 90s, before she was given the most senior State Department position. In that top role, she was central, and this is perhaps very ironical now, given the Ukraine situation. She was central to persuading President Clinton to launch bombing attacks in the former Yugoslavia, leading the NATO alliance in that action then. A necessary military action, it was argued, not least by Ms. Albright herself, because of the wholesale mass murder, so-called ethnic cleansing at the time, if you remember, of the civilian population. Such a military operation for the United States now in Ukraine is, of course, being very firmly kept off the table by the Biden administration and NATO's present-day leadership. Interestingly, I should perhaps mention, in this context of massacring of civilians, is that in retirement, as Albright said and wrote many times, that her saddest regret about her career was the America's failure to step in and prevent the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. Political leaders' memoirs, by the way, can sometimes be stultifyingly boring, but I commend Ms. Albright's memoir called Read My Pins. It's a reference, of course, to her famous use of lapel jewelry, brooches or pins, to make a diplomatic point. When I was at the UN and she was there, we used to call it Madeleine's jewel box diplomacy. She wore a coiled gold snake, you might remember, after Saddam Hussein called her a female serpent, and she sported a massive pin that was obviously a bug. I mean, the insect kind of bug, I should say. This was after the Soviets were revealed, surprise, surprise, to be tapping the U.S. Embassy's phones in Moscow. I can't say this about many senior diplomats at the United Nations, but she was fun to be around.
You know, and it's always tough to be the first of anything. You're breaking new ground, and you're going against tradition. And you know, when you look back at her reign, she did a hell of a job.
She did, yeah. Many substantial successes, and some sort of subtle nudges, shifts, yeah. Pushes. Of the United States in directions that it's hard to ever say that responsibility for historical development is the accomplishment of one single individual, but she certainly played her part in asserting over that particular period a form of leadership role for the United States and the world that we haven't really seen since, and that's to her credit, and it's important to recognize that as we reflect on her extraordinary life. In a way that could bring us around to Ukraine again. Unsurprisingly, yeah. Right up until her death, she was still contributing. And how could she not, really, to national debates about Global Affairs. She wrote, let me quote this to you. This is from the New York Times, an op-ed that she wrote on the very last day, just before Putin invaded Ukraine. She said, instead of paving Russia's path to greatness, invading Ukraine would ensure Mr. Putin's infamy by leaving his country diplomatically isolated, economically crippled, and strategically vulnerable in the face of a stronger, more united Western alliance. Now, Western leaders can only hope that she's right, don't you think?
I think that they do think she's right, and I think that all the talk of how useless NATO was is now way gone out the window, and we see that, you know, something, a good idea, as long as it changes with the times, like NATO, is needed, and more than ever, this incursion into what Putin has done has just shown that, you know what, it's needed. The cooperation is there. It's not always 100% because there's always going to be differences in people, but the importance of a strong Secretary of State and a strong NATO alliance and strong European alliance with the United States is a very big balancing act that keeps the world a lot safer.
Yes, it gets back to that notion of American leadership again, not sort of dictatorial. Bullying kind of leadership, which we heard talk of in recent years, but a first among equals kind of leadership that perhaps unsurprisingly was what the Obama administration was striving for, and perhaps ironically his vice president perhaps is now achieving it in now that he's in the Oval Office himself in his own right.
All right, David, always great to speak with you. There's always a lot to talk about. We'll speak to you next week.
I look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. Once again, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us, and also at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tarachuk.